Well, this morning we find ourselves in chapter 46 of Genesis. Last week was like this climax everything's been building to, where Joseph has tested his brothers and he set up the scenario till finally his brother Judah, who had sold him into slavery, comes forward and offers his own life in exchange for Benjamin's. And when that happened, Joseph realized they are ready for me to reveal who I am to them. And then he reveals himself. He drives everyone out of the room and he tells them to come close. And he says, "Ani Yosef, I am Joseph, your brother." And of course, they were just couldn't believe it. They were terrified. But he again invites them to come and he explains to them what's happened. He says, don't blame yourselves. You know, God is the one who sent me here, not you. And he sent me here to provide a deliverance for you. And then he asks about his father. And so they go home and they take these wagons from Egypt and they finally convince their father Jacob, "Your son Joseph, who you haven't seen in 22 years, is alive and well and ruler of Egypt." And so they load up, they pack up, and now he's heading into Egypt to see his son. So we pick it up, chapter 46, verse 1. "So Israel set out with all that he had, and he came to Beersheba, where he slaughtered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac." All right, stop the music. Why sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac, not of his fathers Abraham and Isaac? Every other place, it's the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Why here is just the God of his father Isaac, and Abraham isn't mentioned? Here's what I think. Isaac had been separated from his son, Jacob, for over 20 years because of deception. And now Jacob has been separated from his son, Joseph, for over 20 years because of deception. And I think that as Jacob packed up everything and began the journey towards Egypt, he gets to Beersheba and he's thinking about this. And finally, the poetry and the symmetry of his father's life and his own began to come together in his mind. And he realized that he had been through what his own father had been through. And what he had caused to happen, the sorrow he had inflicted on his own father by his own deception, God had allowed Jacob to experience by his sons deceiving him. But God, in the end, makes it right. He restored Jacob to his father Isaac, and now Joseph is about to be restored to his father Jacob. I think somehow it occurred to him that his life had rhyme and meaning and symmetry to it, that God was in control, and even the errors that Jacob had committed, even the errors his sons had committed, still became part of God's plan because God is sovereign, and he takes even our mistakes and errors and weaves them into something beautiful when we submit to him. That's an amazing story. There's so much here, we could just stop and talk a whole hour about verse 1. I know you're afraid I will, but I won't, because we have a lot more chapter to go through. And it says, "God spoke to Israel in night visions and said, 'Yaakov, Yaakov.' And he said, 'Hineni, here I am.' And he said, 'I am the God, God of your father. Have no fear of descending to Egypt, for I shall establish you as a great nation there. I shall descend with you to Egypt. I shall also surely bring you up, and Joseph shall place his hand on your eyes.'" In other words, when you die, Joseph will be there to close your eyes. "So Jacob arose from Beersheba. The sons of Israel transported Jacob, their father, as well as their young children and wives, in the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to transport him. They took their livestock and their wealth, which they had amassed in the land of Canaan, and they came to Egypt. Jacob and all his offspring with him, his sons and grandsons with him, His daughters and granddaughters and all his offspring he brought with him to Egypt. Now, question. Why was Jacob afraid to go to Egypt? Because God had to tell him, he said, do not be afraid. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt. And I think we can pretty safely assume that Jacob was afraid to go to Egypt. Why do you think that was? Why do you think he was so hesitant to go there? Yes, Don.
Because what had happened to Abraham.
Yes, very good. Yeah, his grandfather Abraham, in a previous famine in Canaan, decides, well, let's go to Egypt. They have food there. And what a mess that was. He goes there. His wife Sarah is abducted and taken into Pharaoh's home. And from what the scriptures say, Pharaoh actually took her into his bed. And when they do finally come out, they come out wealthy, but they have Hagar with them. And you know how that story turns out. And through Hagar, Abraham fathers Ishmael, who became the father of all the Muslim nations that had been at war with the other children of Abraham through Isaac over all these years. So it was a big mess. And then later, there was another famine in Canaan, and Isaac gets ready to go to Egypt because there's food there. But God intervenes and warns him and says, don't go to Egypt. And so now, here's Jacob. Famine in the land. And now this time, his son is inviting him to come to Egypt. Okay? So Abraham went to Egypt without being told to, and that was a mess. Isaac was told not to go to Egypt. And now Jacob is told to go to Egypt, and God would descend with him. But there's another reason, I think, that Jacob was really hesitant to go. Because God, when he made his covenant with Abraham, told Abraham, this is what he said. It's in Genesis 15, verses 13 and 14. God said to Abraham, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs. For they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. So Jacob had to realize that this trip to Egypt was going to be a long stay and a very unpleasant one. It was going to end in slavery and oppression, followed by deliverance. Okay? So there's a lot of reasons why Jacob really doesn't want to go to Egypt with all of his family. But God says go. Now, why is this? You know, as you go through this chapter, it then goes into a genealogy of Jacob's children and grandchildren, and there are 70 souls. If you go down to verse 27, and Joseph's sons who were born to him in Egypt numbered two persons, all the people of Jacob's household who came to Egypt, 70. When you see 70 people in the Bible, and there are several places where you find 70 people in a group, think seed. God is sowing seed in the world. If you go to the story of Noah, Noah after the flood, you know, there he is with his wife and his three sons and their wives, and the sons are Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And then it gives the genealogy of those three sons, and they result in 70 souls, and those became the 70 Gentile nations in the world. So out of those three sons were sown 70 souls into the world that became 70 nations, 70 people groups. So God's sowing the earth with new human beings. But then with Abraham, God says, oh, you know what? I'm going to make a 71st nation, a special nation. And that's what the nation of Israel is. And now here we see, let's fast forward. You go into the Gospels. And we see Yeshua calling 70 disciples, 70. He had 12 specially chosen ones, but he had 70. It says he sent these 70 out in pairs to all the cities and towns where he was going to come to bring the gospel of the kingdom. So he's again taking 70 souls and sowing them into the land of Israel, sowing the seed. And here we see Jacob and the 70 souls that came from him descending a seed into the womb of Egypt. Mitzrayim, Egypt, means restriction, closeness, heat, and tightness. And it's like a child growing in a womb. And when they come out of Egypt, they're going to be, it says here, a goy gadol, a great nation. In fact, the first time Israel is called a people is in Exodus chapter 1. In Exodus chapter 1, at the end of the period of time of their slavery and oppression, and God's ready to bring them out, finally they're called the Am Yisrael, the people of Israel. They've become a nation now, become a people. And when they came out a great nation. So you see this pattern of 70 souls, 70 souls, 70 souls, as God's sowing things, sowing seed. Now, I saw some hands up. So did I address what you're going to say, or do you have some questions? Okay, Dale has a question. Let's get a microphone to Dale. And if you're visiting, you're welcome to ask questions and share insights. So Dale is not stepping out of line or anything by raising his hand. Okay, all right, go right ahead, Dale.
I thought that he might be afraid to lose his inheritance of the land of Canaan.
Now that's also a possibility. That's also a possibility, because when they did come back, they had to fight again for the land that was theirs. That's true. Good point. Anyone else? Yes, Roger, right here. Let's get a microphone to Roger. There we go.
I think that, when they talk about going down to Egypt, mm-hmm. that's a spiritual, talking about yep. the spiritual.
Yes.
Because Egypt was, it's a low nation.
It was.
He was afraid that took all his family down there.
Yeah.
They were going to end up being trapped in this low nation. Mm-hmm. Never come back.
Right. That's right. Yeah, as long as Joseph was in charge, it was great. But then as Exodus says, then it arose a new Pharaoh, another Pharaoh who did not know Joseph. And it's almost as if it's saying he refused to acknowledge Joseph. He was a completely different character from the Pharaoh who was there this time. Yes, Sharon in the back. Oh, it's right on your other side. There you go.
Closer to the right. I was really interested in counting the number of sons
yes.
that came down, and I found it interesting and the menorah pattern mm-hmm. of paradox that yeah. repeat himself. Dan only had one son, mm-hmm. and eventually Dan really does some naughty, naughty
oh, things. Yes.
Yeah. Son, the way he behaved. And Benjamin, who was always mm-hmm. the innocent one, he was never involved in any of the yeah. bad.
Most fruitful. Yeah.
Of his older brothers, he had 10
yes.
sons.
Yeah.
And Simeon didn't have very many. So I thought it was very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. Because this is really early in the story.
Yes.
Pre exile, being in the land, pre monarchy.
Yes. Yeah.
Well,
Benjamin, yeah, he's the most fruitful, definitely. Yeah, he was a busy guy. So here's another menorah pattern. That when God speaks to Jacob here, did it sound at all familiar to you? God says, Jacob, Jacob. And he says, here I am. Where have you heard that before? Who? What story? Abraham, yes, and Samuel. He calls Samuel twice. That's right. And he calls Moses by name twice. But those stories are still in the future. But with Abraham, God says in chapter 22, this is when he's calling Abraham to take his son Isaac up to Mount Moriah and offer him. And he says, Abraham, Abraham. And here he's saying to Jacob, Jacob, Jacob. And Abraham answers, Hineni, here I am. And so does Jacob. You see, God is asking both men to do the same thing. He's asking Abraham, I want you to offer your only son to me. Give him to me on the mountain. And then he's telling Jacob, Jacob, I want you to take your 70 offspring Now that you've entrusted them to me down in Egypt. Get the difference? He tells Abraham, go up. But he tells Jacob, go down. Abraham, then after the episode with Isaac, he offers a sacrifice to God. But here, before Jacob takes his children and they enter into Egypt, he offers sacrifices before him. So there's a symmetry here. One of the things we're going to do before we finish Genesis, when we get to the end of the story of Jacob, is we're going to take Abraham and Jacob, with Isaac in the middle, and we're going to really analyze, compare the two lives, because it makes the most amazing menorah pattern you've ever seen. And you'll begin to appreciate more and more why God calls himself the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. He does that all through the scriptures. And these three men present a picture of God's working in your life and my life. Because all of us have parts of our lives are like Abraham, and God deals with us in one way. Part of us is like Isaac, and he deals with us on that ground as well. And part of us is like Jacob. A lot of us is very much like Jacob. And he deals with us on that level as well. Okay, so just be thinking about that, because in a few weeks we'll definitely be going into that study. It's a fascinating thing, and every time I go through it, I discover so many things. It's like, how did I miss those before? Now, one of the things he tells, I love verse 4. One of the things he tells Jacob, he says, I will descend with you to Egypt. Second, I shall also surely bring you up. And third, Joseph shall place his hand on your eyes. There's the entire history of the Jewish people in one sentence. God's always with them. He goes down into the midst of all the trouble and the messes they get themselves into, and he goes with you into all your difficulties as well. All of us go through Egypts. Remember, Egypt means restrictions, a place of crushing pressure and darkness and heat. But it's in that we grow. And there's no escaping this journey to Egypt. All of us have an Egypt experience. All of us go through a wilderness experience because God's determined to bring us into the land of fruitfulness. So God is with us. God was with Jacob. God has been with Israel as they've gone into the pressure of Egypt, the pressure of the Holocaust, the pressure of the different exiles they've been in, as a nation and as individuals. But he says, I'm with you and I'll bring you out. There's always going to be an outcome. But then this third thing, he says, Joseph will place his hand on your eyes. Who's Joseph a picture of? Yeshua. You know, there's only two places in the entire Bible where someone puts their hand on someone else's eyes. There's only two places. This is the one. What's the other? Yes, Yeshua heals the blind man. It's over in Mark chapter 8. Here. In verse 23, it starts like this. Taking the blind man by the hand, he brought him out of the village, and after spitting on his eyes and laying his hands on him, he asked him, do you see anything? He looked up and said, I see men, for I see them like trees walking around. Then again, he laid his hands on his eyes. He looked intently and is restored and began to see everything clearly. He's restored and begins to see everything clearly. When Messiah places his hands on your eyes, we're restored and we see things clearly. He might have to spit in our face first. And we think, why are you treating me like this? But we have to trust his heart. It's all for our healing. It's all for our restoration. So when you read about Joseph putting his hand on Jacob's eyes, think of Joseph, who he's the antitype of. He's the antitype, or the type of a Messiah who puts his hands on the eyes of the blind. We were all blind. And he restores us, and makes us to see clearly. But that happens only after we go through Egypt, through restriction and pressure and darkness and pain. And then he brings us out, and then we see. See, we want to see without having to go through any of the other stuff. We want the resurrection life without having to go to the cross. That there's no escaping it. It was a week or two ago, a few weeks ago, Maya, our little granddaughter, had been with us, and she had gone home, and we have this, all of her pictures are beautiful, because she is the most beautiful little girl in the world. I mean, I'm sorry, you all have very pretty children, but there can only be one most beautiful, you know, mirror, mirror on the wall. It's my granddaughter. Anyways, we have this picture of her on the hearth. And Robin looked over, and here's this little four-year-old girl. And she says, I just wonder what life holds for her. And then I got this little epiphany. And I said, I think I know. It's going to hold a lot of joys and a lot of sorrows. That's what it means to be human. That's what it is. Our lives are seasoned with great joys and with great sorrows, but that's what makes our story. That's what makes your story, a story that will be told for eternity. And the only things that matter in eternity are the stories. You know, in this physical world, we think the bigger something is, somehow the more valuable it is and the more popular it is, so we have the biggest building, the biggest winning record of some sports team, the biggest movie star, the biggest whatever. We like big. The biggest church, biggest. We just like big. But big things don't last. In eternity, in the spiritual realm, the things that are big are your stories. Stories that people may not even know yet. Stories that you don't know quite yet because your story's not over yet. But the question is, how big is your story? The story of your life, living your life in your little neighborhood with your family, your circle of friends, going to the widget factory every day, earning a paycheck, living your life, those stories become the eternal things. And nobody in eternity is going to care who won the Super Bowl or who built the tallest skyscraper or who could jump the farthest or had the biggest movie career. Nobody cares. But the stories of Joe Nobody and Annie Anonymous, those are the things that will be eternal, that people will be looking at and rehearsing and telling for eternity. Your story. Invest in your story. Be the man, be the woman God wants you to be. And your story will be told through the ages. I promise you that. I guarantee it. That's what matters. Those are the big things in God's economy. That sounds preachy. I'm sorry. You know what? I wasn't sure if we had time for this, but I'm going to do it. By the way, when you count up the number of people in the genealogy here, it goes through, in verses 9 through 14, it goes through Leah's children. She had six children that she bore to Jacob. So it has her six sons and then their children. And then you've got one daughter mentioned, Dinah, in verse 15. And then it goes to Leah's handmaid's sons, Zilpah, in verses 16 and 17. And you see there are 16 people there. And then it goes to Rachel in verses 19 through 21, her sons and the grandsons, 14 persons in all. And then her handmaid, Bilhah, which became the fourth. There were four wives that Jacob had. And her two sons, and then the number of children they had. And then you come to the grand total of 70. But if you go through and count them all, there's only 69. I don't care how you count it, it always comes up 69 every single time. And yet it says 70 souls descended with Egypt. Well, then people want to wax clever, and they say, well, it's not counting Jacob. He makes the 70th. Or others on the more spiritual say, well, God said he would descend with them. God becomes the 70th. But neither of those work. Because in Exodus chapter 1, I think it's verse 5, it again says there were 70 souls who went to Egypt. 70 souls that emerged from Jacob's loins. Jacob did not come out of his own loins, and neither did God. So who's the 70th? I'll tell you. I don't know her name. But in the first group, Leah's group, in verse 15, at the end it says numbered 33. But when you count, there's only 32 there. So the missing person is in that group. Now, Dina is the only girl that's mentioned in the whole list of names. But after it mentions her name there in verse 15, it says, all the people, his sons and daughters, plural, numbered 33. There's a missing daughter. There's a missing daughter in that group, verses 9 through 15. And somebody should write a book about her. Wouldn't that make a great novel? The missing daughter. Which one was the father? Was it Dina's sister through Zebulun? Who was the other daughter? But there's a daughter missing in that group. So that's the 70th soul. We don't have her name. But God likes keeping little secrets like that. He just does. You know, Esther, the Feast of Esther is next week. You know what the name Esther means? Hidden. Hidden. And her identity was hidden. And all through the story of Joseph, his identity is hidden from his brothers until the very end. And I asked you in an email to look for some Purim parallels, right? Some Purim parallels in the story of Joseph and the story of Esther. Last week I told you I wasn't going to do an Esther teaching, but then this week some things came to light, and I thought, well, we can work it in. And on the way over here, Lindsay started saying, I saw some parallels. She said, you know, Joseph, he arose from being a nobody to being the king of Egypt. And Esther arose from being a nobody to being the queen of Persia. That's a great parallel. But his identity was hidden from his brothers, and her identity was hidden from the king. Each of them became a savior for their people. Right? And so there are a number of parallels there. Things I didn't think of, because I was looking at something else. And Rabbi David Foreman, who's a wonderful teacher, he does the Aleph Beta teachings online. I really encourage you to listen to him. And a friend who emails pointed out one of his teachings. So I went and listened to it, and I thought this would work in perfectly with our story. Let me show you something here. Remember last week, we looked at Judah, the one who had sold Joseph into slavery because he was jealous of him. And so he's gone. For 22 years, Judah has been in pain and feeling guilty for what he did. And so now Joseph's brother, Benjamin, has been brought to Egypt. And Joseph sets it up to where now he's going to... He sets up this scene and makes it look like Benjamin has stolen from him. And he says, okay, I'm going to keep Benjamin as my slave. The rest of you can go home. And then Joseph sits back to see, are they going to do to Benjamin what they did to me? Are they going to let him just be a slave as long as they get off scot-free? Or have they matured to the place where they're going to step forward? And sure enough, it says, Vayigash. And he approached, Judah approached Joseph. And he makes his appeal to him. And here's part of it. Genesis 44, starting with verse 30. Judah is speaking to Joseph, and he says, now therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, when I go home to my father, Jacob, and the lad, Benjamin, is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, when he sees that the lad is not with us, he will die. Thus your servants will bring the gray hair of your servant, our father, down to Sheol in sorrow. Sheol just simply means the grave. For your servant became surety for the lad to my father. He's talking about himself. I, Judah, became like surety, insurance, collateral for the lad to my father, saying, if I do not bring Benjamin back to you, then let me bear the blame before my father forever. Now, therefore, please let your servant, let me, Judah, remain instead of the lad, Benjamin, a slave to my master. Judah's grown up a lot over 22 years, hasn't he? And the one who sold his brother Joseph into slavery is now willing to give himself in place of Benjamin. And when Joseph saw that, that's when Joseph revealed himself. But now look at the last sentence. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, for fear that I see the evil that would overtake my father? That is almost word for word what Esther says to Ahasuerus, the king. Haman was about to, he had hatched a plot to destroy all the Jewish people in Persia. And she goes before the king and she says this. I shortened it down a little bit. Esther chapter 8, verses 3 and 6. Then Esther spoke again to the king, fell at his feet, wept, and implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman the Agagite and his plot which he had devised against the Jews. Verse 6. For how can I endure to see the calamity which will befall my people? And how can I endure to see the evil that will overtake my people? Here are the two phrases in Hebrew. There's only two differences in the two phrases. Judah says, Bara asher yemzah et avi. How can I bear to see the evil? Ra is the word for evil right there. Asher yemzah, that will befall et avi, my father. Avi means my father. Now, for whatever reason, when Esther speaks, she uses the feminine form for evil. Bara'ah, she adds a little letter hey there. Bara'ah asher yemzah et ami. It says, my father, it's my people. Avi is my father, ami is my people. And it's the only two places in the entire Bible where you find this phrase, this structure. When Judah is offering himself for the sake of his brother Benjamin, then Esther is making an appeal for the sake of her people. But it doesn't stop there. We get the name Jew from the name Judah. And when Israel divided, when it became two kingdoms, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom was called Judah because Judah was the largest tribe, the largest amount of land. But with Judah was Benjamin and the Levites. But they all just kind of became known as Judah, as Jews, because the north got scattered. And so we just call people who are descendants of Jacob the Jews. But it comes from the name Judah. Now in Genesis, Judah steps forward to offer himself in place of Benjamin. What tribe was Esther and was Mordecai from?
Benjamin.
And Esther 2:5 says, now there was at the citadel of Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. What we see in Esther is Benjamin offering himself in place of Judah. And it's in the book of Esther, finally, we see what we call the Jewish people from the tribes being called Jew after Judah. And that's why it uses the term Jew here. But most all of the Jewish people there were descendants of Judah in Persia. But a Benjamite steps up. Putting her life on the line to save Judah. So in Genesis, Judah saves Benjamin. And in Esther, Benjamin saves Judah. Look at this one. In Genesis 43:14, what does Jacob say when Judas, when he says, you need to go back to Egypt, get us more food? And Judah says, listen. He said, don't come back here. You're not going to see my face unless you bring your little brother Benjamin with you. You've got to let Benjamin go with us. Jacob did not want to do that. So finally, I mean, there's no food. So finally, Jacob says, may God Almighty grant you compassion in the sight of the man, this is Joseph referring to, so that he will release to you your other brother and Benjamin. And as for me, if I am bereaved of my children, I am bereaved. We're all going to die if you don't go get us food. So if I lose Simeon and Benjamin, I lose them. But if I'm bereaved, I'm bereaved. Look at this, Esther 4:16. Go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me, Esther says to Mordecai. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens also will fast in the same way, and thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law. If I perish, I perish. There are only two places in the entire Bible where you see this particular structure. If I am bereaved, I'm bereaved. If I perish, I perish. Here it is in Hebrew. Asher shekalti shekalti. That's what Jacob says. Esther says, V'kasher avadati avadati. Three words. But it's the same format. You see the T on the end of each of these words? It got just a different verb. Only two places in the Bible you find them. Now I want you to think about this. Just step back, get the big picture. This is not accidental. The story of Jacob and Joseph and the story of Esther happened many centuries apart. Now Esther would have known the story of Jacob, but I don't think she purposely tried to go in there and think, I know what, I am going to say these things and someday somebody will write a book about it and I'm going to make it look just like the story of Judah and Benjamin. She didn't do that. Nobody does that. She didn't know anybody's going to write a book. But God knew. God's the author of this book from Genesis to Revelation. His hand is all over it. You see these authors writing these different books, but there's one mind behind them pulling the strings because he is sovereign. They wrote of their own free wills and their own styles of their own personalities emerging. Yet God is still sovereign, weaving through his patterns, his truth, his light, his purpose from beginning to end. That's the kind of God we have. In the same way, each of you is a book. Each of you has a free will. Each of your stories is being written now. And yet God is weaving your stories in and out of each other's lives in ways we cannot even begin to appreciate. And also with the lives of your ancestors and the lives of your descendants. And someday when we see the whole finished product, it's going to be something to behold. It's going to be something to see. And to think we get to participate in this. To think about that. The very fact that we're sitting here this morning studying the story of Jacob and Joseph and Judah and Benjamin and the story of Esther and Mordecai, it now, these stories become a part of our story. Our story becomes part of theirs. Do you understand that? Across the centuries and across the continents, your story and my story interweaves with these Bible characters, these people who lived and breathed and lived lives and lived out their stories, our lives are intersecting with theirs. We're related and connected, and we'll get to meet them and see how it all fits together someday. What a world we live in, if we could just have eyes to see it. Isn't that great? You just have to stand in awe of such a God. You really do. Well, let me share. This is kind of cool, too. In Genesis 46:28, let's go there. We're in chapter 46. So when Joseph gets word that his father Jacob and everybody's coming back to Egypt, they're almost there. It says in verse 29, Joseph harnessed his chariot and went up to meet Israel, his father, in Goshen. Now remember, what does Goshen mean? It means approaching. This Torah portion is called Vayigash because he approached, Judah approached Joseph. And then when Joseph reveals himself, he tells his brothers, Gashu, Gashu, draw close to me. And then he meets them and settles them in the land of Goshen, the land of approaching. Okay, so you see this all weaving together. And he appeared before him, he fell on his neck, and he wept on his neck excessively. Can you imagine? If you go back to the beginning, how much Jacob loved Joseph, and Joseph loved Jacob, and now they've been separated for 22 years, Jacob thinking that Joseph was dead. Can you imagine the reunion? I want to see the replay of that someday and eternity. Then Israel said to Joseph, "Now I can die after my having seen your face because you are still alive." Isn't that wonderful? That's amazing. But go back to verse 28. This is what it says. He sent Judah ahead of him to Joseph to prepare ahead of him in Goshen. And they arrived in the region of Goshen. And then in verse 29, Goshen. Now, I've highlighted some words here. You see the word Goshen three times, but twice it's to Goshen. Now, in Hebrew, if you have a place of a name of a place, like Israel or Bethlehem or Goshen or Egypt, it makes no difference. If there's a place name and someone's going toward that place, the way you put it is you take the name of the place. Here there's Goshen, Gimel Shin Nun, and you add the letter Hey to the end. It's kind of the equivalent of saying, "Where are you going?" "I'm going Akronward." "I'm going northward." "I'm going southward, eastward, Cantonward." Okay? You put the WARD on the end of a place name, it means that's the direction you're going. Well, that's how the letter Hey works. You find it all the time through the Hebrew scriptures. So, Goshenah. I'm going Goshenward, toward Goshen. And it's used twice in verse 28. Now, why is that important? Because you see, there's a Hanukkah parallel here too. Not just Purim, there's a Hanukkah parallel. Can anybody figure out why those four letters are so important? All right. You ready? Yeah, the dreidel. Those are the four letters you find on a dreidel. They're rearranged. On a dreidel, you've got the nun. See, let me erase this up here. See, there's the gimel and Goshona, and there's the gimel there. The shin, there's the shin. The nun, there's the nun, and the hay, and there's the hay. And we put them in this order because when you read these letters, they stand for the words Nes Gadol Haya Sham, a great miracle happened there. But this is the really cool thing. When you add up the numerical values of these letters, they add up to 358, which is also the word Mashiach, Messiah. Did you know that the letters of the dreidel, their numerical values equal the same as the word Mashiach, Messiah? So go back to the story. Joseph is going Goshenah and almost emphasizes it. He says it twice. It says twice there. It's like, pay attention to this. Because this is the Messiah on the move. When you approach Goshen, you're approaching the Messiah because it's the place of drawing near. And as they're drawing near to Goshen, he's drawing near to them. And isn't that what it says? You draw near to me, I'll draw near to you. And Goshen, drawing near, the place of appearing, of drawing near, that is where we meet the Messiah. Every one of us has a Goshen in our lives. There's some time in our life we bit the bullet and decided, okay, I'm going to go to this place God's sending me, even though I don't want to go there, but I'm not going to be afraid. And who do we see riding towards us but Mashiach? Because he is going Goshenah, we're going Goshenah. And Goshenah means a great miracle happened there. And it's 358, it's Messiah. These are wonders God weaves into his Torah. Isn't it amazing? It really is amazing. What a book. What a book. Andrew, you're having an, and Steve's coming around behind you with a microphone.
Okay, well, the funny thing is that with the dreidel, they're casting lots. They're taking a gamble.
Yeah, it's a game. Yeah, it's a game. To the world, it looks like foolishness. And do you know the story where the dreidel came from? During one of the times of persecution is during the times of Hanukkah, when what's his name, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. He made it illegal to have a Torah scroll and study it. It became totally illegal. So the Jewish people would secretly get together in homes and study halls and study Torah. But there'd be a guy on the lookout for any of Antiochus's men coming along. And when he saw one, he'd give the signal. They'd hide the Torah scroll away, get out their little tops or little dreidels and some change, some coins, and they would spin them, you know, and play this game. And so the guy come by, they're just in there gambling. And then when the guy moved on, then they put the dreidels away and get the Torah scroll back out. So again, you see this hiddenness, don't you? And so that's why it's traditional Hanukkah, to play with a dreidel and have some little chocolate coins you get to eat. But it's Messiah that looks foolish to the world. But we know what's really going on. Because the Torah scroll and the dreidel, see what happens? The dreidel comes out to hide the Torah scroll. Then the dreidel goes away to bring out the Torah scroll. You understand? Okay? I don't know how to put it in words, but you get it. It's a picture. Any other questions or comments? You want to go a little bit further in the chapter? We have time left. I must have either talked a lot faster or whatever, but we'll finish up. We'll go ahead and finish the chapter. Men, yes, go right ahead. Let's get a microphone to you first. It does. Yeah. Oh, I'm glad you brought that in, man, because, you know, as you all know, Billy Graham passed away just a few days ago. But, you know, the secret to his greatness was his humility. He always remained humble. He always did. I'm sure there are times he got up on his high horse, but he immediately either got knocked off or got down. And he stayed humble. And that is why God could use him so much. Moses is the most humble of all men. And look how great he was as a leader. And the secret to, it's counterintuitive, but we're promised in the Word that if you humble yourself in the eyes of the Lord, that in due time, he lifts you up. What's the opposite of that? If you lift yourself up, you will be humiliated, because pride goes before a fall. It's like shooting an arrow out of a bow. If I'm going to shoot the arrow up, if I'm going to make it go as high as possible, I have to pull it in the opposite direction as far as possible. The further I pull it this way, the further it's going to go that way. So the more you can just humble yourself, not false humility, true humility. Remember, humility is not thinking lowly of yourself. It's just not thinking of yourself at all. And the more we can learn to truly humble ourselves, and destroy the ego, the more God can lift us up in due time. And that's where greatness is. That's the key to greatness. So thank you, ma'am, for bringing that up. Yeah. And the word go, I think I shared this a few weeks ago. The word go in Hebrew is Beit Aleph. We pronounce it Bo. In fact, there's a Torah portion called Bo in Exodus where God tells Moses, go, Bo to Egypt. Go to Pharaoh. But what happens when you reverse the letters? They spell Aleph, Beit. They're the first two letters of the alphabet. But that spells Av, which means Father. Whenever we go in obedience, no matter where God tells us to go, we will encounter the Father. So every time we go in obedience to God, we will find Him. We will. Even if He tells you to go to Egypt, you'll find Him. He says, I'll be with you. How about Jonah? I want you to go east to Nineveh. So he gets on a boat going west to Tarsus, you know, and he wants to get out of town. But God still found him and brought him back. And what an encounter with God he had. But you don't want to encounter God by running away. You want to encounter him by obeying him. So any last minute comments? And then we'll just end. All right. That's it. Well, let's close in prayer. Our Father and King, we thank you so much for all the blessings you lavish upon us throughout our lives. And Lord, most of your blessings we're unaware of. Forgive us for that. But Lord, place your hand upon our eyes. Restore us and give us sight so we can see the blessings that we have. The sages ask, who is rich? And the answer, the one who is contented with his lot. And Lord, we have so much in our lives. Everything we need for contentment is right within arm's reach. But we're too blind to see. So Father, open our eyes to the blessings you give us. Open our eyes and behold wonders out of your Torah. Help us to be more like Abraham and like Isaac and like Jacob. All three who failed at different times in their lives, but all three to whom you were faithful, all three who turned to you and repaired things and made things right and went through the pain and also experienced the joys of living a life in covenant with you. Help us to be like them. Help us to be like Esther, who is willing to lay down her life for the sake of her people. And Lord, I pray that you would give us all a realization, a revelation of what is worth dying for. And once we are committed to that, then we will have something to live for. So give us the courage we need to be the people you want us to be, people like our precious Savior and Master, Yeshua, the Messiah, in whose name we pray. Amen.